This is Lee Pettit, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. In this half hour, I'll be reading selected chapters from Arizona Oddities, Land of Anomalies and Tamales by Marshall Trimble. Marshall Trimble is an American author, singer, former community college professor, and Arizona's official state historian. In addition to his position as Director of Southwest Studies at Scottsdale Community College, he's a popular speaker and True West Magazine's question and answer man. In our stories today, we'll learn how camels came to live in the Arizona West, one man's vision of a utopian community on the banks of the Santa Cruz River, and just how hard it was to get from town to town back in the old days. Traveling by stagecoach was no place for sissies. Raphael Pompelli, who rode and wrote about traveling the Butterfield Overland Cross Country in 1860, described a typical journey. Having secured a seat in the overland coach as far as Tucson, I looked forward to 16 days and nights of continuous travel. The coach was fitted with 3 seats, and these were occupied by 9 passengers. As the occupants of the front and middle seats faced each other, it was necessary for those 6 people to interlock their knees. And there being room inside for only 10 of the 12 legs, each side of the coach was graced by a foot, now dangling near the wheel, now trying in vain to find a place of support. My immediate neighbors were a tall Missourian with his wife and 2 young daughters. The girls were overcome by seasickness, and in this having no regard for the clothes of their neighbors. Leaving the station, the driver gathered up the ribbons and shouted, "Turn 'em loose!" Passengers bumped their heads on the roof as the coach bounced along the dusty road. It was sheer novelty at first, but as night fell, the hardships of coach travel was brought to all. Some managed to doze, but never for a long time amid the rumble of the coach. Sheer exhaustion allowed some to sleep after a couple of nights on the road, but others were driven insane by the ordeal. It was reported that during one trip across southern Arizona, a passenger suddenly leaped from a moving stage and ran off screaming into the desert, never to be seen again. One passenger recalled how a runaway team pulled his coach down a steep bank, bouncing the body completely off the running gear. The mules bolted, dragging what was left behind them. After a short distance, the wheels flew off, and when the mules were caught, they were dragging just the axles. One passenger was badly cut and the others stunned, but in 1 hour, after patching the stagecoach together, they hit the trail again. Another wrote, 24 mortal days and nights must be spent in that ambulance. Passengers becoming crazy with whiskey mixed with want of sleep are often obliged to be strapped into their seats. Meals dispatched during the 10-minute halts are simply abominable, the heat excessive, the climate malarious. Lamps may not be used at night for fear of non-existent Indian raids. A surefire way to handle customers' gripes was developed by one driver. We had a way of managing them. When they got very obstreperous, all we had to do was yell, "Indians!" And that quieted them down quicker than 40-rod whiskey does to a man. The driver had unlimited authority on the expedition. Women were special and were treated with great respect. The standard punishment for those who took liberties with a female was to be set afoot, whether in dangerous Indian country or not. It was considered unwise to discuss politics or religion on board. Passengers were appalled by the dirt and squalor that greeted them at the station. Built of adobe with floors much like the ground outside, one wrote, except not so clean, and interiors black with flies. There was little to attract the discriminating passenger. Many stagecoach relay stations had community toothbrushes hanging on strings for the passengers. Meals were worse. Tough beef or pork fried in a grime-blackened skillet, coarse bread, mesquite beans, a mysterious concoction known as slumgullion, lethally black coffee, and a nasty compound of dried apples that masqueraded under the name of apple pie. This went on day after day. The story was told of the station master who set a plate of fat pork before a traveler who said, "Thank you, but I can't eat it." "Very well," came the reply, "just help yourself to the mustard." Shangri-La on the banks of the Santa Cruz River. When one imagines pristine Arizona's dry, desolate, sun-baked deserts in the 1850s, it's difficult to picture any of it as being a utopian Shangri-La. But for a brief period, in a beautiful green valley at the foot of the majestic Santa Rita Mountains, there was just such a place. In his twilight years, Charles Poston, recognized today as the father of Arizona, wrote glowingly of it, "We had no law but love, and no occupation but labor. No government, taxes, no public debt, no politics. It was a community in a perfect state of nature." In August of 1856, Poston, accompanied by a group of German miners and a brigade of rough-hewn Texas frontiersmen described as not afraid of the devil, armed with Sharp's rifles, Colt revolvers, and the recklessness of youth, arrived in the small pueblo of Tucson. They were on their way to occupy the abandoned settlement of Tubac, farther up the Santa Cruz River, and reopen some of the old mines from the Spanish colonial period in the area. He'd explored the mountains west of the river 2 years earlier and found rich deposits of silver. The old Spanish presidio was abandoned and all of the adobe buildings in disrepair. The first order of business was to get the old town up and running again. The three-story tower was restored and served as a lookout. The armory became a storehouse for supplies. Lumber for construction came from the nearby Santa Ritas. The miners found gold in the streams and silver in the mountains. The richest silver mines were west of the river in the Cerro Colorados, where silver assayed out at $950 to the ton. One mine assayed at $7,000. The following year, James Santiago Hubbell, a New Mexico trader, brought a wagon load of goods to Tubac and, on his return trip, hauled a load of rich silver that assayed at $1,500 to the ton back up the Santa Fe Trail to Kansas City, making Americans aware of Arizona's rich silver deposits. Hubbell came to New Mexico shortly after the Mexican War ended. He married Julianita Gutierrez from an old Castilian family. In 1853, their son John Lorenzo was born. As a young man, John lived among the Hopi and Navajo, where he learned to speak their languages. He came to the area in 1876 and, 2 years later, bought a trading post in northeastern Arizona that he named Mucho Ganado in honor of a Navajo chief. Little has changed since the days of Don Lorenzo Hubbell. Today, the Hubbell Trading Post is a National Historic Site and still open for business, serving both the Navajo and tourists. The mining camp Bonanza gave a boost to commerce along the entire Santa Cruz River Valley. Skilled miners were paid $15 to $25 a month, a tidy sum for the times. By 1857, the population in the valley had grown to 3,500, and a military post was established at Calabasas, just north of today's Nogales. Pack trains from Mexico brought in food staples and French wine from Guaymas. Fruit and vegetables were purchased from the nearby mission at Tumacacori. Since the Mexicans couldn't read English, Poston devised a cardboard currency called boletas to pay their wages. Renderings of animals were used to indicate the value. A pig was worth 12.5 cents, a calf 25 cents, a rooster 50 cents, a horse $1, a bull $5, and a lion was worth $10. The revolutions in Mexico and the California Gold Rush had depleted the male population in northern Sonora. In some villages, the ratio of women to men was 12 to 1. This caused a mass exodus of unattached young women who proceeded to head for the boomtown of Tubac. It also became Nagreen for young runaway couples who couldn't afford the $25 fee the priest charged them to marry. Poston was Tubac's jefe, and, by Mexican law, that made him the magistrate or the mayor, alcalde. Poston referred to himself as the El Cadi. He married the young couples for free and even gave them a wedding present. He baptized their babies and, if necessary, granted them divorces. Of the women, Poston wrote, "Sonora has always been famous for the beauty and gracefulness of its señoritas. They really had refining influence on the frontiersmen. Many of them had been educated at convents, and they were all good Catholics. They could cook, sew, sing, and dance." The observant El Cadi also wrote, "They are exceeding dainty in their underclothing and wear the finest linen they can afford." The ladies referred to the American men as los goddamis for their propensity to use the term with so much frequency, and the few American women were las camisas colorados due to their fondness for red petticoats. They could give a good account of themselves in men's games of chance. They were experts at cards and divested many a miner his week's wages over a game of monte. Alas, it was too good to last. The archbishop in Santa Fe, Jean-Baptiste Lamy, dispatched Father Joseph Machbeuf to Tubac to check things out. Shocked at this perfect state of nature, Machbeuf immediately declared all of the marriages performed by Poston null and void. Naturally, there was much wailing and dismay in Tubac. Something had to be done to quell the unrest, so El Cadi and the Padre worked out a deal. Poston would make a charitable donation of $700 to the church, the priest would remarry the anxious couples, and all transgressions would be forgiven. Unfortunately, things got ugly in a hurry. In September 1857, a California adventurer named Henry Crabb led a group of some 40 filibusteros, or land pirates, from California into Caborca, Sonora, and tried to set up a little country of their own. The Mexicans retaliated and killed them all, then imposed an embargo, making it unsafe for Americans to cross the border. Then, some Sonoran rancheros, in pursuit of Apache raiders, crossed the border and invited Poston and his men to join them in a punitive expedition to reclaim some 300 horses and mules that had been stolen. They promised to divide up the animals reclaimed equally. Up to then, Poston had an agreement with the Apache to not interfere with their traditional raids from their strongholds in the mountains to the north, through the Santa Cruz Valley into Mexico. He refused their offer, so the Mexicans headed north to the small settlement at Canoa and made the same offer. These were newcomers from Maine who were cutting lumber up in the Santa Ritas and unaware of the arrangement. Unwittingly, they joined the Mexicans. They succeeded in routing the Apache and reclaiming the stolen livestock, but at a high cost. A few days later, the Apache swept down on Canoa, annihilated the settlers, and destroyed the camp. In late 1860, a youngster named Felix Tellez, the stepson of John Ward, was kidnapped by a band of Aravapai Apache at Ward's ranch nearby Sonoyta Creek. Cochise, living with his band in Apache Pass, was the usual suspect in any mischief in the area. In early 1861, a young army lieutenant named George Bascom led a force of soldiers from Fort Buchanan to Cochise's camp and falsely accused him of kidnapping the child. Cochise denied taking the lad, and when the soldiers attempted to take him hostage, the chief managed to escape. In the aftermath, several were killed on both sides, including some of Cochise's relatives. Up to then, Cochise had been relatively friendly with the Americans, but he declared a take-no-prisoners war that lasted for 10 years. The so-called Bascom Affair coincided with the outbreak of the Civil War. All the military posts in Arizona were abandoned, and the settlers were left to fend for themselves. Felix Tellez grew up among the Apache, adopted their ways, married an Apache woman, and took the name Mickey Free. He went on to become one of the great scouts for the U.S. Army during the Apache Wars. Charles Poston's thriving little utopia was no more. The Apache moved in once again, destroying the town, looting and slaughtering both Mexicans and Americans. Mexican bandits killed and plundered innocent residents in the Santa Cruz Valley. The bandits killed Poston's brother John at Cerro Colorado. Poston left Arizona in 1862, barely escaping with his own life, and headed for Washington to promote separate territorial status for the place folks were now calling Arizona. The territory of Arizona, created from the western half of New Mexico, was established on February 24, 1863. In 1899, the territorial legislature officially recognized Poston as the father of Arizona and awarded him a small pension. He died 3 years later and was buried atop a lonely butte north of the town of Florence. High Jolly and the Camel Corps. One of the West's most bizarre events took place along the Colorado River on a gray January morning in 1858. A camel caravan, looking like something right out of the Arabian Nights, was preparing to cross the Muddy River. A group of camels plodding across the desert was indeed a peculiar sight. Their strange mannerisms and homely looks were a great curiosity to the local natives, but prompted mules and horses to stampede. This unfamiliar event was followed by something just as outlandish in the Mojave Desert. A tiny boat, belching steam, was churning its way downstream, its noisy, wood-burning engine hurling billowing clouds of black smoke skyward. The steamboat, the General Jessup, and Skipper George Johnson were returning to Yuma after exploring the Colorado River to learn more about the navigability upstream to Black Canyon. The camels were returning to New Mexico from California following their successful survey of the 35th parallel for a wagon road between Albuquerque and Los Angeles. Although this chance meeting in the middle of nowhere was accidental, both were part of a grand plan by the U.S. government to establish passageways through and across the vast terra incognita that was now a part of the United States. Both are relatively unknown chapters in the illustrious history of the West. The United States had just acquired 529,000 square miles of virtually unexplored and unmapped land as a result of the recent war with Mexico, all or parts of today's Arizona, Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Colorado. About that same time, gold was discovered in California, and thousands of immigrants were heading west. They were going to need roads to get there. The storied Army Corps of Topographical Engineers was charged with surveying these transcontinental roads from the Canadian border to the Mexican line. This elite group of soldier scientists, established in 1838 and handpicked from the top graduates of West Point, was a separate unit for only 23 years, but during that short time, it gained more knowledge of the terra incognita than in the previous 300 years. And they probably did more, in proportion to their small numbers, toward the winning of the West than any other group in American history. In those days, before specialization, these young engineers were required to have a working knowledge of botany, biology, ethnology, geology, ornithology, anthropology, and meteorology. Since cameras weren't available, they were trained as sketch artists to record both the animate and inanimate. These unsung heroes who mapped the roads west were the prototypes for the seven Apollo astronauts of the 1960s, who set out to explore another new frontier. Future transcontinental railroads would follow these same surveys, and a century later came interstate highways. Before the coming of the railroads, the task of transporting goods across the great southwestern deserts was never an easy one. The terrain was rough enough to tear up the feet of horses and mules. Water was always scarce, and lack of suitable forage for the animals made it necessary to carry the feed on pack animals, taking up valuable space. A beast of burden was needed that could pack a heavy load, live off the natural resources along the way, and travel a long distance without a drink of water. Secretary of War Jefferson Davis wanted to test the feasibility of using camels as beasts of burden across the waterless land. The great camel experiment would be unique in the annals of Western exploration. During the Seminole Wars of the 1830s, Second Lieutenant George Crossman first came up with the idea of using camels. He pitched the idea to Major Henry Wayne, who in turn pitched to Mississippi Senator Jefferson Davis. When Davis became Secretary of War in 1853 through 57, he pitched it to President Franklin Pierce for an appropriation. After Congress appropriated $30,000, Major Wayne, accompanied by U.S. Navy Lieutenant David Porter, set out on the USS Supply to the Middle East to purchase some camels. On February 15, 1856, the ship embarked for America with 33 camels on board. On the way, one died and two were born, so they arrived on May 14th with a net gain of one camel. A year later, another shipload arrived, increasing the total by 41. The man chosen to lead the survey of the 35th parallel was the irrepressible Lieutenant Edward Fitzgerald "Ned" Beale. Beale, a graduate of the Naval Academy, is undoubtedly one of the unsung heroes of the American West. His life story reads like something out of a dime novel. In December of 1846, he was with General Stephen Watts Kearny's Army of the West when it was pinned down and under siege at San Pascal, near San Diego, during the conquest of California. Beale, Kit Carson, and a Delaware Indian scout sneaked through enemy lines and traveled on foot to San Diego for reinforcements to rescue the trapped American force. Following the discovery of gold in California, Beale was chosen to carry the news to President Millard Fillmore. Disguised as a Mexican, he made an epic dash through Mexico, outriding his pursuers and shooting his way out of several scrapes. He delivered a pouch of gold nuggets to the White House, proving the gold discovery was not a hoax and triggering the California gold rush. The arrival of camels in the American Southwest failed to bring a chorus of cheers from the packers and mule skinners. They should have been welcomed, as they could carry more than 700 pounds of baggage, live off the local forage, and go for long periods without water. They could travel anywhere from 35 to 75 miles in a day. Alas, the homely beasts were extremely stubborn, had terrible breath, and were known to be extremely temperamental. Couple that with a spirit of intractable independence, and they were difficult to manage. The Mule Skinners hated them. Packers and Teamsters cursed them unmercifully. The language barrier presented no small problem. The Americans couldn't speak Arabic, and the camels wouldn't learn English. Following the old adage, "It takes a camel driver to drive a camel," the government had the foresight to import camel drivers. They were a colorful bunch with names like Long Tom, Short Tom, and Greek George. These weren't their given names, but had to do, as the Americans couldn't pronounce their Arabic names anyways. The most famous of these was Haji Ali, and since that one didn't roll off the tongue, his name was corrupted to High Jolly. His original name was Philip Tedrow, and he was born in Greece around 1828 of Greek and Syrian parentage. At the age of 25, he converted to Islam and took the name Haji Ali. Later in life, he reverted back to his given name. By the middle of August 1857, the Camel Brigade was on its way. Accompanied by the Middle Eastern camel conductors in their traditional garb, the caravan made a colorful spectacle as it passed through villages along the way. Lieutenant Beale looked and played the part of a circus ringmaster riding in a wagon painted bright red. The camels were packing 700 pounds, twice what the mules could carry. Beale usually rode a mule, but for a social call on a military post, he climbed on a white camel named Said. No doubt the appearance of a military officer sitting high on a white camel had the desired effect. Beale couldn't have been more pleased with his camels. They endured the arid lands between Albuquerque and the Colorado River especially well. During a stretch of 36 hours without water, the horses and mules suffered, but the camels didn't falter. On the contrary, the camels gazed at the frenzied animals with contempt. The powerful mule lobbyists in Missouri and Washington were the most vocal opponents of the camel experiment. They threw a hissy fit. In reality, they didn't like the competition. However, Lieutenant Ned Beale, the officer who implemented the camel survey, championed their attributes, calling them lovable and docile. When the camels were assigned to Beale, he had been adamantly opposed to them. But the more he came to know them, their endurance and ability to cover great distances, the more he became their biggest supporter. Still, he had a hard time convincing others, especially when whole pack trains were known to stampede at the mere sight of the camels. The beasts passed the supreme test when Beale was challenged to pit his camels against Packer's mules on a 60-mile endurance race. Using 6 camels against 12 mules, a 2.5-ton load was divided among the camels and 2 army wagons, each drawn by 6 mules. The camels finished the race in 2.5 days, while the mules took 4. On October 17, 1857, the camels arrived at the Colorado River near Needles. At first, the camels eyed the river with suspicion, so the Teamsters urged some horses and mules to cross in order to encourage the camels to follow. When the heavy current swept the animals away, the camels became even more contentious. High Jolly selected the strongest camel in the herd to swim the river, and after he swam across with ease, the others followed suit. With High Jolly singing to encourage his camels to swim the swift current of the river, they successfully crossed with no losses. 2 horses and 10 mules were lost on the crossing. The bodies of the horses and mules were gathered in by the local Indians, who butchered and then held a feast. The camel caravan reached Fort Tejon, California, in November, still carrying their loads of 600 to 800 pounds. Their historic mission was accomplished. The outbreak of the Civil War in 1861 ended any hope for the building of a railroad along the 35th parallel in the near future. The government had no more use for its camels, and they were either sold as military surplus or turned loose to roam the western deserts of Arizona and California. The Army's experiment with camels was short-lived, but High Jolly remained in the Southwest. For the next 40 years, he would divide his time between delivery of the U.S. mail, hauling freight over roads he had helped to explore and establish, prospecting, and serving the cavalry as a scout and mule packer. He met Gertrudis Serna in Tucson, and they were married in 1880. The couple had 2 daughters, but Philip continued to drift and finally took up residence around Tyson's Well. Gertrudis and Philip remained estranged until his death in 1902 on the road between Wickenburg and the Colorado. He'd gone out looking for a stray camel. Later, some cowboys working cattle came upon his body, his arms wrapped around the neck of the young camel. Both had perished in a sandstorm. The name Philip means lover of horses, but in reality, Philip Tedrow was a camel whisperer. In 1934, the last camel from the original group, died at the age of 80 at a zoo in Los Angeles. The average life of a camel is 50 years, so the climate of the Arizona desert must have suited him. The last camel, a descendant of the original herd, was captured in the wilds of Arizona in 1946. When the rails did cross Arizona in 1883, they closely followed the survey Beale and his camels made nearly a quarter century earlier. In 1912, the wagon road became part of the National Trails Highway, also known as the Ocean-to-Ocean Highway from the Atlantic to the Pacific. On November 11, 1926, federal highway officials put the finishing touches on the new 2,400-mile interstate between Chicago and Los Angeles and named it Route 66. But that's a story for another time. That'll do it for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm volunteer reader Lee Pettit. Join us again for more Arizona history here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.